Nelson, we have a podcast.
Diving deep into all things Texas, both on and off the field. Here's Sean Pendergast. Welcome to Utopia.
Hey everybody, welcome in. It is a Tuesday mailbag edition of the Utopia Football Podcast. Great to be with you. I'm Sean Pendergast, the one half of Payne and Pendergast on Sports Radio 610, Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. Appreciate you guys tuning into the show, tuning into the podcast as well. We got a lot to get to. We got a big mailbag to get to here. You guys are coming out in droves now that the season has started. 1-0. Do a quick check of the power rankings that come out every Tuesday morning and find that the Texans, in the five power rankings that I subscribe to, I don't mean literally subscribe to. I guess in some cases I subscribe to the services that provide the articles. But nevertheless, the five power rankings nationally that we use on the show for our world-acclaimed segment, Power Ranking of the Power Rankings, ESPN, CBS, The Athletic, SI.com, and NFL.com. Texans are anywhere from 10th in SI.com all the way up to 4th on The Athletic. 4th. Only three teams separating the Texans from football heaven. So the Texans are off to a great start. 1-0, the only undefeated team in the division, and around the country, people are seeming to buy in that this team is for real, that they can be on the short list of Super Bowl contenders. I just looked at the odds to the Super Bowl before I jumped on the podcast to record. 14-1 as we sit right now, about 6th on the board, I think. So right about where you would expect a team that has this much talent, this much optimism and hope, but also not really the pelts on the wall to be, you know, somewhere between 6 and 10, and mostly skewing towards the upper end of that bracket there. So the Texans getting a lot of love right out of the chute, kind of matching up with all the love they've been getting in the offseason. So nothing new there. Before we get into the mailbag, a quick reminder to subscribe, rate and review the podcast, whether you're streaming it on video on YouTube or whether you're listening to it wherever you listen to your auditory podcasts, whether it's iTunes or Spotify or whatever the case may be. Odyssey, obviously, the big one, the Odyssey app, since they pay me. Should mention that. So there you go. But yeah, if you hit the subscribe button, especially now that the season has started, then you don't have to go looking for the podcast. We do a Tuesday mailbag. We do a late in the week preview of the upcoming game, and we do a right after the post game show podcast. So three podcasts, barring something huge happening. If there's something big, a trade or an injury or something like that that gets reported, then we're not afraid to do a bonus or an emergency podcast here with the Utopia podcast. The only bit of news with the Texans, they re-signed Desmond King today and signed him to the practice squad. That's about it. They've got a pretty clean injury sheet. They got out of that Colts game pretty clean. It's been a fairly uneventful training camp and season so far from a medical standpoint, other than the guys that, you know, worked out off to the side, most of whom are on the team now. Christian Harris is probably the big one, and he'll be gone through at least week 4. The earliest we would see Christian Harris would be the Buffalo game in week 5. But no real news, Texans news to report. But there is one big news item in the league, and I've gotten a few emails from you guys to the mailbag about this morning. So let's just call this the start of the mailbag portion of the show. Again, if you look at the bottom of the screen there, if you're watching on video, come on, there we go. HOUmailbag@gmail.com. HOUmailbag@gmail.com is how you can email us. Come on, get back up there, graphic. Let's go. There we go. But a lot of you have been emailing me about the Deshaun Watson situation. So I'll give you my take on that and just call this, you know, the five of you that emailed me this morning with various thoughts on Deshaun Watson. I'll write a post about this for the Houston Press. But my thoughts on Deshaun Watson, I guess I should just lay out maybe the 30-second version of what's going on. 30 seconds on something that probably needs at least 5 minutes to lay out. But Deshaun Watson is being sued again. That news came down in the middle of the afternoon yesterday that he's being sued by a woman who, we should mention off the top, is being represented by Tony Busby. So that Busby represented the women who were suing Deshaun 2 years ago, at least one of whom is still suing Deshaun. There's at least one woman that did not settle with Deshaun that's still sitting out there. But this is a totally separate woman. And this is a case that has a lot of, or a lawsuit, I should say, that has a lot of the same elements as the massage lawsuits. The big difference here is this is a woman that's saying that she had a date with Deshaun, that she gave Deshaun directions to get to her apartment. He was late getting there because he couldn't find the apartment. He was very agitated, according to the lawsuit. And when he got there, he sat on her couch while she was getting ready. She got ready with the door open, putting on makeup and whatnot. And next thing you know, he's laying down face down naked on her bed, asking her to rub his butt. And which that's the part that's very similar to the massage lawsuits, where the road diverges, that this woman is accusing Deshaun of true sexual misconduct, i.e. rape. So there's some really disturbing things in the lawsuit, as there were in every Deshaun lawsuit that we saw. But this goes to another level. This is not in a massage setting. This is Deshaun, according to this woman who is going by Jane Doe in the lawsuit, that Deshaun forced himself on her. This is bad to worse for Deshaun and for the Cleveland Browns and for really, honestly, everybody involved. Thankfully, the Texans are no longer involved with Deshaun Watson. This is something that we're watching from the outside looking in. This is a Houston woman. This took place back in October, allegedly, back in October of 2020, October 10th, 2020, which if you're looking for kind of a something to calibrate for you, where that, like when that was, it was during the COVID season. October 10th was literally 1 week after Bill O'Brien was fired. Bill O'Brien was fired on October 3rd or 4th. This took place a week later. So in week five of the season that year is when this took place. So super disturbing stuff. The questions now, and there have been no comments from anybody on this, at least that I've seen yet. By the time you're listening to this, then maybe somebody's commented on it. But there have been no comments from the Browns, from the NFL, from Deshaun Watson. The only side we've heard so far is the side of the plaintiff, of Jane Doe. And by proxy, Tony Busby, whose law firm is representing her. So, there are a lot of ways this thing can go. I know there's a lot of Cleveland fans right now that are wondering about the football side of this. And I'm not saying they're bad people for doing that. Obviously, I'll preface all of this by saying if what's in the lawsuit is true, it's terrible. And pray for the plaintiff and all this. This is a sports podcast, so the sports ramifications of this need to be discussed. The big question is, did Deshaun let the Browns know that this was a possibility when they traded for him back in March of 2022? Because Deshaun has a specific clause in his contract where he had to tell them prior to, you know, signing the contract, he had to disclose if there were any more possible women out there that could come forth. And we don't know to this point if he gave them any names, if he gave them names, if this was one of them, if this was one of the women that could come forth with something. So until we know that, we don't know anything as far as what could be dished out in terms of the personal conduct policy, because the suspension that Deshaun was given, the 11-game suspension that Deshaun was given, which, by the way, we should point out, the judge who handed down that suspension does think that Deshaun did all the things that he was sued for 2 years ago. So that's important to note. That doesn't necessarily mean that he did the things he's being accused of in this lawsuit, but it does show that there's at least one judge out there that feels like Deshaun Watson has a very disturbing pattern of behavior. So if he had told the league and the Browns before he signed that contract about this particular possible case, there's a chance that was already baked into the suspension. If this is something new that he hasn't told anybody about, he could be subject to the personal conduct policy. The league will do an investigation again, I would imagine. And he would get a suspension that would certainly exceed 11 games, I would imagine. And then comes the question of, does this get the Browns out from under the contract? Typically, if a player runs afoul of the personal conduct policy, the guarantees in their contract go away. which would be a gift from the gods for Cleveland because they're still on the hook for at least nearly $100 million in guaranteed money. His salaries the next 2 years, I believe, add up to $92 million. They're already on the hook for a ton of dead cap space on with all the previous salary that they've turned into bonus money each of the last 3 years. There's $80 or $90 million sitting out there that the Browns are not going to be able to get out from underneath from. But they may be able to get the last 2 years of Watson's deal voided. Because here's what I think happens. If Deshaun Watson gets suspended and it voids the last 2 years of his deal, I think even if they're left with a Russell Wilson-sized cap hit, call it $80 or $90 million bucks, and that's about what they've shoved into future years. Deshaun's cap hit the next 2 years is $72 million, $72 million. They've got another $24 million sitting in a void dummy year at the end. Like, this is a horrible, horrible, horrible contract for a horrible, horrible quarterback and possibly a despicable human being. So this is, and by the way, they traded a king's ransom for the right to be in business with this guy. This is the worst trade in the history of trades in any sport, maybe the worst transaction, the worst business transaction that any corporation has ever been part of is the Deshaun Watson contract. So even if they have to take a massive, massive Russell Wilson-sized cap hit, I think Browns fans, I've listened to a lot of Cleveland radio, I think they're just done with him. I think if the Browns were able to get out from the $46 million salaries next year and the year after, and they just have the rest of the dead money, call it $80 million, sitting there, I think the second Deshaun Watson gets suspended, once they confirm the guarantees in his contract are gone, he's done as a Cleveland Brown. He's done. They'll cut him. They'll get rid of him. And this is their only way out. In a weird way, the Cleveland Browns, behind closed doors, are probably rooting for the fact that Deshaun Watson may have sexually assaulted somebody. I'm not saying they necessarily are, but if they're trying to get out from underneath the contract in a weird way, and they probably won't, they'll never say it publicly, obviously. But there, it's really sad, man. Like, Cleveland's only ticket out of being the dumbest franchise in the NFL is for Deshaun Watson to have sexually assaulted somebody. It's so backwards, man. It's so backwards. And at that point, if they cut him, I don't know that Deshaun plays in the NFL again. Like, why would a team? I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe he gets tried criminally at some point. Like, certainly nobody's signing him imminently, so he might be done. With football, if the Browns cut him, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility if we're playing this thing forward. And until we hear from Deshaun or the Browns, and it's today's Tuesday, so it's an off day for everybody in the NFL, until we hear from somebody, we're left to do this, speculate. So hopefully that answers a lot of the questions that you guys had from the emails that I got about this. I don't, you know, there's a lot of stuff with Deshaun that it's easy for us here in Houston to kind of sit back and laugh at and go, like, the fact that he's shitty at football is hilarious to me. The fact that he's getting paid $46 million a year, fully guaranteed to be shitty at football, is hysterical to me. That Cleveland thought that they pulled off the coup of the century by getting him is really, really funny. The fact that the Texans have been able to stack their entire roster, that there's nearly a dozen players that have some sort of attachment draft-wise to those picks they got from Cleveland is amazing. But this one is just like, this is just like sad, man. Like, you know, this is, it's bad. So, but I'm sure he'll, you know, post his next Bentley that he bought on Instagram and his $10,000 puppy dog and his girlfriend, and all will be well. So there you go. All right, let's get to the actual mailbag sender part of the mailbag. Hopefully that helped out with the Deshaun stuff with you guys. Let's start off with Matthew Kosecki. Said, you find a genie that can control the fate of your favorite football team. I love Matthew's genie questions. The genie tells you that you can pick two Texan starters to exceed everybody's expectations and two Texan starters to have disappointing seasons. Your goal is to select these four players in such a way that gives the Texans the best chance at a Super Bowl this year. The genie says you can't pick C.J. Stroud, but everyone else is on the table. Okay, I would say the two that I would pick to have starters we're talking about here to have disappointing seasons. I would say, wait, hang on. My battery's about to run out on my computer. I don't want that to happen in the middle of the pod. Yeah, there we go. I would say let's start with the two starters to exceed my expectations. Now, this email may have come in before the first game of the year, so this one feels easy. Joe Mixon's got to be one of them. Joe Mixon, I think the expectations are he's 900 to 1,000 yards, and he's, you know, 7 or 8 touchdowns or whatever the case may be. If the Joe Mixon in week one exceeded everybody's expectations, I think that's fair to say, right? He's leading the league in rushing right now. Joe Mixon is definitely one of them. If you get that Joe Mixon for 17 weeks in the playoffs, this team's going to the Super Bowl. So I would say Joe Mixon would be one. And as far as overachieving expectations, you know who I'm going to pick? I am going to pick, I think Kenyon Green's expectations actually have risen a little bit after one game. He was really good. I'm going to say Titus Howard, because I think Laramie is going to be Laramie. Titus Howard still, I don't know what to expect from Titus. He's played very little right tackle in the last couple of years. He's been injured a lot. I think if Titus Howard exceeds expectations, you got two real bookend tackles. I know they say they've got two real bookend tackles, but I'm not sold on Titus. So I'll go Joe Mixon and Titus Howard. The thing about the other positions, like wide receiver is so good, I almost feel like I could pick one of the receivers to fall, to be one of the two that fall below expectations, and the offense is still going to hum. So I'm going to say, I'm not going to say Stephon Diggs, because I don't want to experience Stephon Diggs. I don't want to experience him having a disappointing season. I'm not saying he's going to be a turd, but I'm not saying he won't be a turd either. I'll say Tank Dell, and I will say disappointing. I'll go with Shaq Mason. How's that? I'm going to bury the other disappointing season at right guard. Even though I'm not trying to diminish the importance of the interior of the offensive line, I don't want to be in a world where Nico Collins or Stephon Diggs, I don't want to be in a world where Tank Dell is having a disappointing season, but Nico, I think, is already beyond having a disappointing season. Tank, we'll see how many touches he gets and whatever. So those would be mine. I think if Tank Dell underperforms a little bit, you get a little bit of underperformance on the interior of the O-line, but you get a career year from Joe Mixon and Titus Howard, I think you're in really good shape, man. I think you're in really good shape. Good question, Matthew, and your imaginary genie. I look forward to seeing her again next week. Cody from McMahon. By the time this question makes it to the next podcast, the Texans are either 1-0 or 0-1. With that said, tell me why we should not overreact to the start. I love this. This is like one of those storybooks where you pick a direction. If we won, which we did, because CJ Stroud, okay, tell me why we should not overreact to the start. If we won, because CJ Stroud threw for 1.5 miles and the defense shuts out the prolific Richardson-Taylor attack, why is this not going to be the norm? Okay, we didn't win. They shut down the prolific Richardson-Taylor rushing attack, I would say. So I feel good about the run defense. CJ throwing for 1.5 miles, he didn't in this game. This was actually a Joe Mixon game. CJ was great. He threw for 234. He was super efficient. He's a little rusty in the first half, I thought, but by the second half, he was cooking. Why is this not going to be the norm? I think they're going to have a really good rushing defense. I'm worried about the big plays that they gave up. I don't think that's going to be the norm, though. I don't think if you're telling me the Texans are giving up 354 plus yard plays every week, I just don't think they're going to do that. Now, are they shaky on the back end? Could the things that we saw with the big plays with Anthony Richardson in that week one game manifest themselves in other ways in games where it's not necessarily 54 yard plays, but it's busted coverages and things like that? Sure. I guess after one game, my big concern would be that just the secondary and the discipline back there in the secondary. Is Jimmy Ward getting old? Like Jimmy Ward looked old at times in that game. Kalen Bullock did not. So there's that, you know, so there's a reliever warming up in the bullpen. So I'm not exactly sure how to frame the question or frame my answer, Cody, because I'm not totally sure like what you're looking for here, but I think the Texans found some balance in week one. So I think that's safe to say is as long as Mixon is upright, they're going to run the football and he's going to run it better than anybody has since Arian Foster. And I feel like the defense, they did some things that were disappointing in week one, but I don't know that they're things that are going to rear their ugly head. Let's put it this way. It would have been way worse if it was 29-27 Texans win, but the Colts ran for 180 yards in that game. You know what I mean? that Anthony Richardson hits three prayers down the field, or two prayers and then one where it's just a coverage bust and the guy just takes it to the house, Ashton Doolin.
Yeah.
That game shouldn't have been close. Play to play, the Texans were the much better football team in that game. John emails in. People asked if it was Brady or Belichick that won all those Super Bowls, but after watching Nick operate the Texans front office for a while now, deftly managing the Watson trade while building a talented roster, has your opinion changed on how valuable he was to the Patriots? That's an interesting way to pose the question, because I don't know that I ever had a real public opinion on how valuable he was to the Patriots, because I didn't know. Maybe it's just the way you're wording it, John. Like, has my opinion changed? I didn't have a strong take on what Nick's influence was with the Patriots in the first place, because I think everybody assumed that Belichick controlled everything. So maybe that's what you're talking about. Has my opinion changed on whether Nick was truly valuable there or not? Maybe so. I think it's really hard not to connect those dots with the Patriots. That as soon as Nick left the building, they started spending in completely undisciplined ways in free agency. Their drafting, which wasn't all that great even when Nick was there, got really bad once he left the building. So, yeah, I think, is it Brady or is it Belichick? It'll always be Brady for me. But as far as how, like, if we're going, is it Caserio or is it Belichick? I'm still going to say it's Belichick. You know, he's the coach and he was technically the GM too. But I think for us to say, like, Nick was a super valuable part of it. Look, I think there's a reason why they went after the Texans for tampering charges. I think there were probably guys in the building there that Belichick would have been perfectly fine letting walk to go be a GM. There were multiple times that Belichick stopped Nick from becoming the Houston Texans GM until he couldn't anymore. So I think that says it all right there as far as just how valuable he was treated while he was there. So yeah, I think Nick's awesome at his job. I think he's on a roll right now. He's really good. Appreciate the question, John. Neil Diamond emails, Joe Mixon is a fucking beast. That is all. Discuss. I'll say this about Joe Mixon. Joe Mixon, when he was running it on Sunday, that just looked so different than everybody, including Devin Singletary, who ran the ball well at times last year. Certainly looked way different than Damian Pierce. Joe Mixon and the offensive line did a great job, too. We should point out that was the best the offensive line has played in run blocking since Bobby Slowick and D'Amico Ryans got here. So there's that. But Joe Mixon's ability, man, to find the seam, plant his foot, head upfield, listening to the way he described some of the runs. Man, he's just, I feel like that's what it's like hearing a piano player describe what it's like to play the piano. And I'm just sitting there going, I would never know. I can't ever learn how to play the piano. This person sees things differently. You know, Joe was talking about that 3rd-and-3 run to clinch the game. And he talked about, these things that he's describing all are happening within less than 2 seconds. And he's talking about how one linebacker did something, so he switched the gap on him. I'm listening to him describe this. I'm going, man, this is very different than I'm guessing Damian Pierce would describe it if he were asked about it. You know what I mean? Like, Joe Mixon just sees it a little differently than most anybody. And that's after years and years in a system like this. You know, I wish I had the audio. I'd play it. But listening to Mixon describe it was really fascinating to me. I'm guessing if Damian Pierce were describing getting a 9-yard run on 3rd-and-3, he'd be like, man, yeah, seven pitch me the ball. I mean, when I get the ball, man, I run with bad intentions. I'm just looking at, and that's fine. That's Damian. That's why we love him. But it's also why he's getting 3 carries in that game and Joe Mixon's getting 30 carries in that game. So, Neil, I don't know if that's what you're looking for me to discuss. I'm just glad Joe Mixon is a Houston Texan. He is a fucking beast. You're right. David says, Sean, did you ever publish your annual season prediction by buckets of should win, might win, etc.? I never did. I used to do an annual preview for the Houston Press this year, each year, and I'm pulling out the Texans schedule right now because maybe I'll do it on the fly here while we're talking on the podcast. But I'll describe to the audience how I used to do this. I would put the games into 3 different buckets. And the buckets were must win, coin flips, and steals. And a must win is basically a game where you're favored by a substantial amount and if you're going to be a playoff team, you have to win a majority of those games. Like, you've got to win. You've got to win. I'm going to get a pen out so I can do this here. You've got to win. Like, if there's 8 of them, you've got to go 7-1 if you're going to be a playoff team in games like that. The coin flips are the games that are 50-50. Like, this Indianapolis game would have been a coin flip game. You know, the spread's within 3 either way, like inside of a field goal. And then steals are games like you're going into and you just don't feel you're like a substantial underdog. Like, if you win that game, it's a steal. And in a normal season, you need to have at least one of those. You know, if you've got 5 steals, you've got to go probably 2-3 or 1-4. At worst, 1-4, maybe 2-3 in those games. And you know, do the hokey pokey, turn yourself around. And if things play out, then you're an 11 or 12 win team. I would say with the Texans, let's do this exercise right here, as long as we're doing it. I would say coin flips would be the Indy game. Week 2, Chicago's a must win. Minnesota, must win. I think they're going to be like a 4 or 5 point favorite at Minnesota. Home for Jacksonville, I'm going to say coin flip. Home for Buffalo, I'm going to say coin flip. There may only be a couple steals on this schedule, actually, or potential steals. At New England, must win. At Green Bay, coin flip, especially if Jordan Love doesn't play. Home for Indy, I'm going to say, you know what? I'm going to say must win. If they were a 3-point favorite in Indy and they won, they're going to be like a touchdown favorite at home. At the Jets, coin flip. Home for Detroit, coin flip. So we've got 6 forward, 10 games in. Dallas, they could be like a 4.5 point under. I'm going to say Dallas, coin flip. Fuck Dallas. At Jackson or home for Tennessee, must win. At Jacksonville, week 13, coin flip. Home for Miami, we'll call that one a coin flip. At Kansas City, steal. Home for Baltimore, I'm going to say coin flip in the end of the year. And then at Tennessee, both Tennessee games are must win. So there's only one steal. There's one steal. There's 11. There's one steal. There's, I'm sorry, 10 coin flips and 6 must wins. So let's say 5-1 in the must wins. Let's say the coin flips, there's 10 of them. Let's say you split those, so that's 5-5. So that's 10-6. So there you go. You know, you steal the Kansas City game, you're 11-6. You lose the Kansas City game, you're 10-7. So I mean, I hope that was easy to follow along with on the podcast, but that's kind of my formula. You know, like, you put the games into buckets, you got to win a majority of the must wins. The labeling on the game is dependent on how good the Texans are. You know what I mean? Like, the David Culley Texans probably had 0 must wins in their entire bucket. They may have had very few coin flips, even. They were double digit underdogs in a majority of their games. So even if you apply that formula, there were 0 must wins. There were probably 2 coin flips at most. And then there were, you know, 16 steals. You know, so you steal 2 or 3 steals, you get, you know, you split the 2 coin flips, you become 4-13, like Culley's team was. So I feel good about my 11-6 prediction. Yeah. 6 must win games. They go 5-1 in those. 10 coin flip games. They split those like you would coin flips, 5-5. And then you got to steal that Kansas City game, and that gets you to 11-6. So there you go. So, David, did I do that? Did I publish it? No, but I just did it verbally on this podcast. How you like them apples? All right, let's keep it moving. Thank you for that question, Dave. Hey, David, thank you for being a longtime follower of my content. I mean, I haven't done one of those for the Houston Press in years because they've been out of print since 2017. I still write digitally for them. But that preview that I did with all that was always for the print because it paid a lot. There you go. I'm a mercenary. Andy asks, what was wrong with Mechie yesterday? We wanted to see him play. He got scratched. Xavier Hutchinson and Robert Woods are viewed as better options right now than John Mechie III. And I don't think that's a crazy thing. They like Robert Woods. They like his veteran presence. And Xavier Hutchinson had a better training camp than John Mechie overall. So I think that's the answer. I don't think there's anything wrong with him other than he just needs to be better at football than those guys. Chuck in Denver. Great outcome from week one. Mixon was refreshing. I had this game as an L, so we are ahead of schedule. Biggest concerns are the secondary. Will that work itself out? And pass protection. Still favored in all but four games on the rest of the schedule. Oh, I haven't looked at that. Yeah, they. I'm guessing the four games that they're not favored in the rest of the way are Kansas City, Dallas, the Jets, and maybe Baltimore at home. Does that sound about right? I'm guessing those are the four. I feel better about the Baltimore game after watching week one, both the Texans and the Ravens in week one, if you want to know the truth. With Mixon having a great game, I feel like winning nine games is a lock. Chuck says, going to hammer the over now on the wins. Back to your biggest concern, the secondary. I'm not worried about the pass protection. I think they'll be fine. I think Laramie's still coming back from his injury. I think they'll protect CJ just fine. I thought they protected him better in the second half of that game. It got a little cleaner in the pocket for him. So I think they're going to be fine. The secondary, I think, is a concern. You know, Kamari Lassiter had his first game. I haven't gone and watched the All-22 to see how he did, but that's going to be a concern all year against teams with good receivers, that Kamari Lassiter gets the rookie treatment. Jalen Petrie still isn't totally trustworthy in coverage, or as we saw in this game, in tackling. Bad tackle miss on Anthony Richardson on a long run that Richardson had. And Jimmy Ward, you know, Jimmy Ward had left some bad plays out there. I thought Stingley was okay. Stingley had a really good PFF grade in this game. I don't know that I saw that. I don't blame him for the 60-yard touchdown. Like, he's chasing Alec Pierce all the way across the field. The ones that were disturbing were the Adonai Mitchell plays where he got open, but Anthony Richardson just missed him. I thought Stingley tackled really well in this game. Those are the biggest concerns. I think it's fair to say those are the biggest concerns. I think depth at linebacker is still a concern for me, although Henry Toa had a really good game against Indianapolis. I thought he had another good PFF grade for the team. I'm feeling good about the team, man. I'm feeling like A- about the Texans right now. You know, if I had a power ranking, they'd be like 7th or 8th right now, probably, in the league. Chuck, I always appreciate you. Here he is. Brats in the North. You know what I just noticed today? Joe Q sent me a bunch of emails, but I don't know that any of them had questions in them. Now that I'm seeing some of you regulars in here, this might be my first mailbag ever without a Joe Q. Joe Q, have you sent one with a question? The thing is, Joe Q sends like 5 emails a week, so that could be the problem. But Joe Q, I just don't want to disrespect a regular emailer like that. So anyways, there's no Joe Q in this mailbag this week. There is a France in the North. British Brooks had that monster hit off one of the kickoffs, but I did notice Cade Stover playing a bunch of fullback afterwards. Your thoughts? Do you believe they'll continue to have Cade split time there? I do. Cade did well, I thought. Whether it was lined up as a fullback or sometimes he lines up at a fullback and then kind of splits out off to the edge there. He got big props from Joe Mixon in the postgame. Cade Stover did. So they may have found something. I can't remember a time where using a tight end like that has really worked well for the Texans. And I'm going all the way back to James Casey back in 2012, who I love, but they tried him at fullback and it just, you know, it wasn't great. Cade Stover. Cade Stover's still learning how to play tight end, let alone fullback. So there's that. France in the North also asks, if Pierce has games like Sunday where he isn't a liability, do you see a tough road for Cam Akers to make the lineup, or do you think Pierce is on a short leash? If Pierce were on a short leash, he wouldn't be on the team. So I don't know. Like, I have no idea what to think of Damian and how long his leash is. Like, if he were on a short leash, I don't think he'd be a Texan right now. So I think they being D'Amico and Nick, I think they're seeing something different than what we're seeing. They see something behind the scenes. They clearly know things behind the scenes because Nick did it again on our show last week where he talked about some personal issues that Damian was having during the season last year, which clearly seems to be baked into their evaluation of him. So there is that. So I think it's going to be Damian. I don't even know that it's going to be a matchup thing. Now, I hope I like Cam Akers being on this team. Problem for Cam Akers is he doesn't play on special teams other than returner, and they've got a returner with Steven Sims and Damian Pierce. So there you go. France in the North coming in for the Buffalo game, dude, right? Right? Confirm that for me, France in the North. I want to meet you and your family at the Buffalo game. I want to see all you guys, man. Like, if you're a listener to this podcast, we still got a few more questions to get to. I've got 3 more to get to here. But if you're out there and you're going to the game and you're tailgating this week and you're heading into the game, please stop by and see me and Seth at the pregame show at the stage right outside there, man. Take pictures, say what's up. I got to get some merch for the loyal Hutopia listeners, man. I got my got the numbers back on the podcast, and we're continuing to grow and grow and grow. And I can't tell you how thankful I am that you guys tell people about the podcast and share it and stuff like that. Means a lot to me. So yeah, if you're at the game, come by and say hello. And those of you who have already, I appreciate that. If you come by and you've said hi to me before and I don't remember, I apologize ahead of time. That's a peril of the radio business, is that sometimes it takes us a couple of times to meet people before we totally internalize it. When we've got so many people at the pregame coming at us, I sound like a bit of a douchebag right now, but I just want to put that out there in case you're somebody who's come up and said hello before. Like, don't take it personal if I say nice to meet you and we've met before, because it happens from time to time. So I say it's coming from a place of compassion, not a place of me thinking I'm the shit, even though I kind of am. Just joking. Okay, let's keep it moving. BK, let's see. One of the reasons that chaos stood out is because, he's talking about the end of the half stuff with the refs in week one, is because D'Amico is always aware, and I think he and the Texans got jobbed on it, costing us 3 points. Basically, what BK is saying right there is if there was something that looked like a D'Amico fuck-up, it had to be a ref fuck-up, because D'Amico is typically on point with things. The only thing I would say about that, and here's the thing, CJ and D'Amico, if they get asked about that again, like, that's so in the rear view now. It's Chicago now. They could give two shits about something that happened at the end of a half of a game they won. So we're never going to get an answer on it, probably. But I would have to guess that, A, the referees in that game sucked at communicating what the situation was to CJ and to D'Amico, that they thought they communicated it, but they did it poorly. But I think some of it's on D'Amico and a little bit CJ, but more D'Amico because he's the boss, to absolutely 100% confirm and know what's going on in that situation. And D'Amico wore it. He said coming off the field, like, this is, I'm not even mad. You know what I mean? Like, D'Amico just said what I said. He's the head coach. He's got to be on that stuff. He's right. BK says, Joe Mixon ran through that fearsome defensive front like a man ready to take your girl, your wallet, and your house. Yeah, okay. That O-line, which I was worried about, really got their mojo working and straight up pancaked some dudes. Kenyon Green, well done, young man. I agree with you, BK. Kenyon Green, go find it. Seth Payne, first of all, if you're not subscribing to Seth's YouTube channel, you should. Seth's got a great cut up of Kenyon Green highlights. I don't know if he's posted it on social media or if it's only on his YouTube channel. It's really good though, and it should get you super psyched about Kenyon Green. BK closes out by saying his question for the Pender King. I agree this game was the most important as it was divisional on the road against the second best team in the AFC. Based on the rest of the division smelling like bitch last week, wow. Do you still think the Colts are the second best? Oh, I get it. I see. I've seen that meme. I've seen it with the Texans and the other three teams. It smells like bitch in here. Yeah. Do I still think the Colts are the second best team? I 100% do. Given both the other teams gave up double-digit leads, how are you assessing the other division games? I think we all knew the Titans would suck, but turns out Jacksonville is still on an epic losing streak. And then he says, Sunday's going to be tough, ... on my liver, a full day of drinking, then Sunday night football. Good thing you did all those two-a-days. Is that what you're saying, BK? As far as the rest of the division, I'll stand by what I said about the Titans. I think they're going to be one of the worst five or six teams in football. I don't give two shits about everybody they picked up, Ridley and Legarius Sneed. I mean, they're all really nice moves. Those are good players. Will Levis is your quarterback. Will Levis went and lost that game. Will Levis is Will Levis. He's not going to turn into a smart player all of a sudden. He's dumb. He's a dumb quarterback who likes mayonnaise in his coffee. So I don't think much of the Titans. And Jacksonville, just, you know, Jacksonville feels like an 8-9 team. So I think, could they split with Jacksonville? Absolutely they could. You know, Trevor Lawrence is better than Will Levis, certainly. So I feel the same about both of those teams. Like, I think I picked against both of them this past weekend, I'm pretty sure. And so I think I picked against them in my pool that I'm in, so that they lost isn't, you know, is not a surprise. And that they're blowing double-digit leads to do it just means they are what they are. They're not great football teams. Chris in the ATL, I think one of the biggest plays overlooked in the game was the Colts' first drive and Steichen deciding to pass on a fourth and one versus handing it to Taylor, kind of reminiscent of last year's game. That turnover on downs flips the field position. Texans took advantage. Yep, they got a 50-yard field goal. If the Colts keep that drive alive and score, that could have been the difference. The Colts fan base should be pretty frustrated with Steichen after last year's end and this opening loss. That's a really interesting take, Chris, that two of the most important fourth downs, gotta have it, short yardage, heading in the same direction in back-to-back games, back-to-back drives, because it was the last drive of week 18 and the opening drive of 2024. It was week one of this season. So back-to-back drives. Ooh, writing that down. I said I was going to close the book on this game. Back-to-back fourth. Sorry, guys. When I get a good idea, I got to write it down. Thank you, Chris. Should they be mad? Yeah, sure they should be mad. I mean, fans get mad at play calling in some fashion every week. That was a big one, though. And you're right. That was an early momentum. You know, the Colts convert there. They go down and get points. You know, maybe the Texans. This doesn't strike me as a Texans team that gets snowed under in atmospheres, though. Like, I don't think this team, and this is what's really fun, whereas the Texans teams that Bill O'Brien coached and that were quarterbacked by Matt Schaub back in the day, I think, and some of this is on Kubiak too, but I make it more a function of Schaub in big moments with that team, and then I make it a function of O'Brien in big moments with the better teams that he coached, the 10-win, 11-win teams that he coached. I felt like there was not enough dog in the leadership positions to feel like you could reasonably go into an atmosphere like that and win games. And it played out that way. Like, O'Brien got smoked in big atmospheres like that. You know, the Kansas City game, most notably. Kubiak and Schaub, you know, they not only lost in the divisional round, they'd get blown out in the divisional round. New England they did. They actually held up pretty well against Baltimore with T.J. Yates at quarterback. So I just think, I don't know that those two teams, the two good iterations of Texan football, latter part of the Bill O'Brien era, 18 and 19, and the 11 and 12 teams, those are like the four best teams other than last year's Texans team. I just don't think they were equipped to win big games on the road. I do think this group is. And so you're going to ask, why didn't they win the Baltimore game last year, Sean? I don't think they were talented enough to beat Baltimore last year. I think those other Texans teams, especially the Kubiak teams, were definitely talented enough to go win games and not get blown out in big, loud, primetime atmospheres. This team can go win games on the road. They've got that kind of dog in them. Like, that stadium on that 3rd and 11 that Nico caught was insane. And I had people in that stadium tell me it was insane. Pat McAfee said that was the loudest he might have heard that stadium ever during the fourth quarter of that game. So, yeah, feels good, man. Feels good. Last one, Derwin and Cyprus. Clint Sterner tagged Mixon as the most gifted Texan. I think that's what he said. I think Clint said Mixon is the most gifted most gifted running back the Texans have had. I would debate Clint on that with Aaron. I would take Arian Foster and let Clint take Mixon, and I feel like we'd have a really good debate on who the most gifted athletically, most gifted running back is. Like, the overall skill checkbox of running back stuff, I feel like I could have a really good debate with Clint. Because Mixon is a bigger, stronger guy. I think Arian is faster. Arian's got more like breakaway. Like, Arian scored some 70-yard touchdowns in his career. You know, Mixon is more of a bell cow, like churn out yards. Arian has a lot more smooth jazz to his game, I think, whereas Mixon is kind of a bull in a china shop. Mixon has a little bit of wiggle, and Arian has a little bit of physicality. You know, like, I feel like there's some real similarities with them, but there's some stark differences. I think Arian could have played wide receiver in the NFL, probably, I think. I think they're both three down backs for sure. They're very similar. I'm surprised Clint is as dismissive of Arian Foster as he is in that argument. Brings up the fact that he was undrafted. He was undrafted because he was viewed as having attitude issues and he was a little overweight at Tennessee. I don't think it was his skill set that made him undrafted. You could see Arian's personality, how it might rub some NFL personnel people the wrong way at the combine, couldn't you? So I say all that to say Derwin is asking me which Texan I feel has the best chance to win an award this year. We took home offensive and defensive rookie of the year last year. Who do you have your money on? Is D'Amico the best coach in the division? I've had a lot of people ask me that. Is D'Amico the best coach? Is his staff the best in the division? Hell yeah, he is. Better than Doug Peterson, better than Shane Steichen, better than Brian Callahan. Yes, D'Amico is the best coach in the division. I don't care that Peterson won a Super Bowl. Who do I feel has the best chance to win an award? I'll go CJ MVP. I don't know that anybody has a great chance this year. Like last year, CJ had you could tell after a couple weeks, a great chance to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. Will was in kind of a dogfight all year. For most of the year, it looked like Jalen Carter was going to win it, and then Will kind of stole it at the end. I think D'Amico to win Coach of the Year is going to have to win probably 13 games and get the number one seed. You win Coach of the Year by doing one of two things. What D'Amico did last year, which is take one of the perceived worst teams and make them a double-digit win team, or you take a team that's already thought to be good and you make them great. So D'Amico can't go 10-7 in the division, ain't going to get it done this year unless he has to do it with Davis Mills. You know, kind of like Stefanski had to do it last year with multiple quarterbacks who were all better than the guy they were starting, by the way, the beginning of the year. So I don't think it's going to be D'Amico only because I don't think they're going to win 13 games this year. Comeback player of the year. The only one they have on the odds board there is Tank Dell, but he's 40-1. So I don't think he's going to win that. Defensive player of the year. I don't know. It would be Stingley or Daniil or Will. And I don't see any of those three beating out like Nick Bosa or TJ Watt or Micah Parsons. And so then it boils down to, yeah, MVP. You know, unless Joe Mixon turns into a 1,700-yard rusher and he wins Offensive Player of the Year. Because that's kind of – Offensive Player of the Year is typically like best non-quarterback to on offense. Like Christian McCaffrey won that last year and Lamar Jackson won the MVP. I think CJ's MVP is our best chance of getting one, Derwin. Say all that to say that. All right, that was fun. We've got a preview episode coming up of the Texans and the Bears. That'll be coming out later this week, probably on Thursday of this week. We'll bang out that episode. And then you guys should have an episode ready to go Monday morning following what we hope is a Texans win over the Bears. Texans nearly a touchdown favorite in this game on Sunday. We'll preview that more later in the week. So if you want to send me an email, if you've heard these emails, you're like, hey, I'd like to hear mine on the show, houmailbag@gmail.com, houmailbag@gmail.com. Again, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. We appreciate you doing that and helping us out there. Podcast continues to grow, and it's because of you guys. So thank you. So for my producer, Anthony Irwin, I am Sean Pendergast. We are out of time. Thank you all for listening to the Utopia Football Podcast. We will see you later this week.